This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's Beyond the Pages. The book selections for this hour are designed for middle grade and high school listeners. This program is supported in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. My name is Lavender, and I am happy to be with you today. I will continue reading from the book, When You Reach Me, by Rebecca Stead. I was thinking about how much Mr. Tompkin would hate the idea of a place where all the houses look exactly the same, when something stung me hard behind the ear. I jerked my head up and saw Julia laughing silently over her book. I looked down on the floor and saw the rubber band she had shot at me. At my head! I thought we were just irritating each other, but I was wrong. This was war. Invisible things. The next time I saw Marcus, I was absolutely sure he would remember me. I was in the main office because Mr. Tompkin had sent me down to pick up some mimeographs. Why you kids need diagrams of the water system is beyond me, Wheelie said as she handed them to me from her chair. They're for Main Street, I told her. We're trying to make working hydrants. Well, that may be the silliest thing I've ever heard, she said, waving me away. I love the smell of new copies. Mom says I have an attraction to dangerous smells, her main example being the fact that I love to stand in a warm cloud of dry-cleaned exhaust and take deep breaths. There is something very food but not food about the smell of dry cleaner exhaust. She always pulls me away and says that she's sure in 10 years we'll find out that it causes horrible diseases. I was walking back toward the stairs, quietly inhaling the smell of the 32 freshly copied diagrams of the New York City water system, when Marcus came out of the stairwell reading a book. Hey, I said, but he walked right by me, past the main office, and around the corner to where the dentist's office is. Back in class, I passed out the diagrams like Mr. Tompkin asked me to. I accidentally ripped Julia's before I gave it to her, and accidentally crumpled it a little too. Alice Evans was squirming in her chair like she was doing a hula dance. I rolled my eyes. No wonder she was the only sixth grader who had to bring an extra set of clothes to school. Things you hold on to. According to Jimmy, there's a $2 bill in circulation for every 12 $1 bills. But people hold on to them, he said while I was putting on my jacket to go to the store. The light bulb over the sink in the back room had burned out, and Jimmy didn't have any extras. People think $2 bills are special. That's why you don't see them around much. Yeah, I thought, people like you. But I kept my face blank, because I wasn't supposed to know what was in his Fred Flintstone bank. They hate him over at the A&P, though. No space in a cash register for a $2 bill. They gotta pull out the tray and store them underneath. And they always forget they're in there. That's why you have to ask for them. Okay, I said. I'll ask. Anne Marie was behind the counter with her apron on, looking happy. Some kids from school had come in, paying customers, and she was writing their names and mayonnaise on their sandwiches before pressing her perfect V-tops down onto them. Colin was next to her, doing the same. Anne Marie gestured me over. I noticed that she was either very warm or she was wearing makeup. I'm going to ask Jimmy if we can have meatballs for lunch, she whispered, since it's Thanksgiving tomorrow. Great, I said, even though I didn't find those meatballs any more appealing than my usual cheese sandwich. They just sat there in the pot day after day. I'll be back in a minute, I told her. If anyone orders hot chocolate, tell them to wait for me. There were no $2 bills at the AMP, and when I got back to Jimmy's with the light bulbs, the kids were gone, and Julia herself was standing in front of the sandwich counter. Anne Marie and Colin had started making their lunches already. Jimmy had said no, I guessed, to the meatballs because they were picking through the cheese. Julia, who was pretending I hadn't just walked in, seemed to be in the middle of a long speech about how American cheese wasn't even real cheese, strictly speaking. I saw her long fingers gesturing toward the not cheese, and I knew instantly that her V-cut would be flawless, that by Monday she would be behind that counter with Anne Marie and Colin, and that her apron, the same kind that looked gray and baggy on everyone else, would somehow be perfect on her. She would have a way of tucking it up to fit, some trick a waiter in Paris had taught her. Then Jimmy came out from the back room holding a stack of dripping plastic trays. You, he pointed at Julia with an armful of trays. Out! I already told you once! Julia snatched her hand back from the setup tray. Anne Marie flushed. We're just talking, Anne Marie said. There's no customers here now. Actually, I'm a customer, Julia said, crossing her arms over her chest. I came to buy a sandwich. I have money. She stuck out one pretty boot so that the green leather tip pointed at the ceiling. Out, Jimmy said, practically growling. Now! After she left, I pretended, along with Anne Marie, that Jimmy was a little bit crazy. But as we walked back to school with our cheese and lettuce sandwiches, I carried a new warm feeling inside. Jimmy could be a grouch, but he saw right through Julia, just like I did. Salty things. On the Friday after Thanksgiving, there was no school, but Mom still had to go to work. I'd been trying hard not to think about them, but I spent a good chunk of that morning worrying about your notes. I held one in each hand and read them over and over. The part about writing a letter wasn't too scary. The scary parts were, I'm coming to save your friend's life. And, oh, by the way, where do you keep your keys? And, P.S., don't ever tell anyone about any of this. Seeing my name written out on the second note was also pretty creepy because I was still trying to pretend the notes weren't really meant for me. And also where you wrote, I won't be myself when I reach you. I didn't like that part at all. Come to think of it, there were a lot of scary parts. After a long time, I put the notes away and turned on the television. I had been watching TV for 2 hours when I heard Louisa's regular knock. Potato trip drop, she said when I opened the door. She was in her uniform, holding up a plastic bag. Louisa is always bringing mom food from the nursing home where she works. She doesn't steal. It's leftovers from lunch, mostly little bags of potato chips or animal cookies. The health department says that once something has been served on a tray, it has to be thrown away, even if no one touched it. So Louisa takes all the little bags home and gives them to Mom, who brings them to the pregnant jailbird, quote-unquote, parenting group. She runs downtown. Once a month, Mom takes the subway down to this actual jail and talks to criminal pregnant women about what to expect after they have their babies. They all think she's some kind of saint for bringing them potato chips and animal cookies. Mom says that jail is a hard place and that it can make people hard, too. It changes them, she told me once. Jail stops them from becoming who they might grow to be. Isn't that the whole idea? I asked. It's supposed to stop them from being criminals. She shook her head. That's not what I mean. A lot of people make bad mistakes, but being in jail can make them feel like a mistake is all they are, like they aren't even people anymore. Her bringing the chips and cookies is supposed to help somehow. It's not really the cookies, she says. It's the fact that someone brings them. I took the plastic bag from Louisa. She smiled at me. You know what? You're getting tall. I leaned against the doorway. You think? She nodded. I miss you, Miranda. It was the first time either of us had said anything about the fact that I was never at her apartment anymore. Yeah. Her saying she missed me made me feel sort of hopeless for some reason. When she left, I lay on the couch with the TV off and my eyes closed, and I listened for Sal's basketball. Hearing it made me feel better for once. That sound was like the last thread connecting us. Mom didn't talk much at dinner that night. She was still in her work clothes, a denim skirt and a T-shirt with a picture of a coffee cup on it and the words, "Get your own," underneath. Richard had brought strawberries over for dessert. Darn it! Mom threw down a strawberry. SSOs again! I bet the grapes are delicious. I gave her a fake smile. Don't start, Miranda. I had a lousy day. You did? Richard's eyebrows went up. I didn't know that. How would you know? Mom asked. You were in court all day. It isn't much to you if the copier breaks, isn't it? Did anyone ask you to type 3 copies of a 16-page document? Richard shrugged. But you're done now. It's over. Why let it wreck your whole evening? Oh, stuff it, Mr. Perfect. Mom stomped off to her bedroom without even giving him a chance to tap his right knee. Richard looked at me. What did the 0 say to the 8? I rolled my eyes. Nice belt. He'd been telling me that one for at least a year. Later, Mom stacked the dishes in the sink, turned the faucet on, and went to change her clothes. I stood there and watched as the greasy saucepan overflowed onto the plates underneath. The oily water reflected the light and made the whole thing look like a sparkly fountain. Sometimes I can stare at something like that for a long time. Mom came back wearing sweatpants and started washing the dishes. I opened my math workbook at the kitchen table. A minute later, Richard came in and said, "Didn't I leave that extra pair of work shoes here a few months ago? I know they were in the closet, but I can't find them anywhere." Mom's head snapped up. "I knew it! I just knew it! We had been robbed after all." Things You Pretend. The Monday after Thanksgiving, we were stuck in the school cafeteria for lunch. The naked guy was back, running down Broadway, and they wouldn't let any kids out of the building. "Kind of cold out there to be running around in your birthday suit," Colin called over to us on his way to a table of boys. Anne Marie giggled. I could see Sal over there. He'd glanced toward us once more, but acted like he didn't see me. I watched the boys for a few seconds, all of them trying to talk louder than the other ones. Sal was doing it, too. Every once in a while, I could hear his voice on top, and it reminded me of this game we used to play on the crosstown bus on our way to the city pool. Sal would be holding on to the silver bus pole, and I would grab the pole right above his hand. Then he'd move his hand so it was right above mine, and I'd put mine on top of his until we were on our tiptoes, holding on to the pole near the very top. And usually some grown-up would say to stop fooling around. Couldn't we see the bus was crowded and one of us was going to fall and knock somebody over? Anne-Marie picked at her food. The worst part of being stuck inside for lunch was that we had to get school lunch, which was gross. I wonder if Jimmy will count the bread order himself, I said. I bet he won't. I think he just likes to make me do it. She nodded. To give you something to do. Gee, thanks. I threw my milk straw at her. Hey, I didn't mean... Sure you didn't. Then her smile faded. She was still looking at me, but something had changed, like a switch had been flicked inside her. Like she was still there, but was doing something else in her head. Anne-Marie? Don't. Julia was standing behind me with a carton of milk in her hand. Before I could say anything, she slid onto the bench next to me, still looking right at Anne-Marie. She'll be fine in a minute. What's wrong with her? Just wait. Julia hadn't even glanced at me. Her eyes never left Anne-Marie's face. Anne-Marie moved her head a little. She put her arm down on the table, blinked, and said, "What?" as if she had maybe missed something I'd just said. "Are you okay?" I asked. Julia hit my knee with hers under the table. "Don't ask her questions," she hissed. Anne-Marie noticed her just then. "Hi, Julia," she said, and a smile came over her face. Julia smiled back. "Hi." Then she turned to me. "So, Miranda, how's the playground going? For Main Street, I mean." She wanted to talk about Main Street? Now? Her eyes held mine. "I heard your proposal was approved. Congratulations." "Congratulations?" "Thanks. Will there be swings? How are you going to make them? It was dawning on me that Julia was showing me something, teaching me how to help Anne-Marie. "Paper clips," I told Julia. "I'm using paper clips to make the chains for the swings, and I'm going to cut pieces of rubber tire for the seats." Julia was nodding. "That sounds great," she said. I could almost imagine us being friends, having this conversation for real. "What else?" she asked. "What?" She looked annoyed. I wasn't catching on fast enough. "For the playground, what else?" "Oh, well, seesaws. Definitely seesaws." Then Anne-Marie spoke. "You know, balsa wood would be perfect for the seesaws. It's really easy to cut. I think my dad might even have some." "Really?" I asked. "That would be great. We could paint them orange, just like the ones in Riverside Park." "Yes," Anne-Marie said. "We can start them at my house. Maybe even today if you want." She looked at Julia. "Want to come and start Miranda's seesaws?" Before Julia could answer, I said, "There's no rush. I just got the plans approved. We can start next week. Anyway, Anne-Marie, you were coming to my house today, remember?" I felt Julia pulling away. "See you guys," she said and stood up. "Bye," I said. Anne-Marie looked up at her. "Bye, Julia." A few minutes later, the PA system crackled to life, and Anne-Marie was called to the nurse's office. Anne-Marie shrugged, smiled, and walked away, saying, "See you in a minute." But she didn't come back. Things that crack. Outside our classroom, Julia waited for me with her hands on her hips. "God, you're an idiot. You're an idiot. You know that?" "I'm an idiot? She's been eating all that bread at that stupid job you got her. She's not supposed to eat any of that stuff. Idiot. I didn't get her the stupid... I don't even know what you're talking about. It's her epilepsy, idiot. You total idiot. Her dad has her on this special diet. He makes her special food. She's not supposed to eat bread or drink soda. She's not? No, she's not, idiot. And by the way, what's your problem with me anyway? I'd really like to know. What? Your problem with me? What is it? Besides the fact that you've called me an idiot 6 times in the last minute, besides the fact that you shot a rubber band at my head, she waved all that away as if I had mentioned some silly detail. I'm talking about way before that. You've hated me forever. You've been giving me dirty looks since like 3rd grade. Are you going to pretend you haven't? I stared at her. Some feeling had started in my stomach and was traveling up to my face, and I knew that when it got there, I would turn bright red and hear the ocean, which is what happens when I get pushed on the spot. If I don't cry, I turn red and hear the ocean. It's a lose-lose situation. What are you talking about? I said. I have no idea, she said. I really don't, but a person knows when someone hates her. At least I do. She flung her arm down and her little silver watch flew off her wrist and hit the floor with a crack. A very sharp, final-sounding sort of crack. Her precious watch! I'm not proud of this now, but that sound, which echoed in the tiled hallway, made me really happy. I sucked my bottom lip so that I wouldn't smile. Julia bent down to pick up the watch. I thought she would start to screech, but she just flipped it over in her hand and looked at it. A web of tiny cracks covered the face like a cobweb. Oh, great, she puffed out her cheeks and exhaled slowly. This whole day just stinks, she said, and she walked away. On the way home, I found myself walking half a block behind Sal again. I'd learned not to run and catch up to him. He would only look at his sneakers and not talk. So I watched him bobbing along in his navy blue knit hat, his head going from side to side a little, like it always does when he walks. I think he thought that hat looked tough the way he had it pulled down to his eyebrows. Then Marcus came out of his dented front door next to the garage, wearing that green army coat he always wore. He started walking down the block towards Sal. Even half a block behind him, I could see Sal's body hunch and slow down. I knew what he was doing. He was looking for a way out. Should he pretend he needed to cross the street all of a sudden? That he had just remembered something he needed to buy at Bell's? But it was a little late for that. Marcus was almost in front of him. I could have called out to Sal at that moment. It would have been easy. He would have an excuse to turn around and start walking away from Marcus. And then Marcus might have stopped to talk to me for a minute, and Sal would have seen that it was all okay. He could have dropped his fear of Marcus right then and there. I've thought about this a lot because I realize it would have changed everything that happened later. Instead, I watched, and what Sal did was squat down and pretend to tie his shoe. It was a plea for mercy. Dropping to tie your shoe was an I can't fight, I can't run, I bow down before you sort of a move. Plus, just in case some hitting did occur, it protected important body parts. I kept walking while Sal crouched there on the sidewalk and Marcus walked right by without even noticing him. And then Marcus walked right by me. Things left behind. Guess what? Anne Marie said when I called her at home that night to see if she was okay. Someone left a rose on our doormat. For you? I don't know, maybe. Of course it was for her. Who else would it be for? Was there anything with it? A card? No, just a rose. Her voice sounded all thin and excited. Weird, huh? I wonder. Hey, can I ask you something? Are you not supposed to eat bread? She was quiet. It's not a big deal. Just that Julia said, no, she interrupted. It is sort of a big deal. I should have told you. I have epilepsy. Oh. And I'm not supposed to eat bread or starches. It's this crazy diet my dad read about, but it actually works. I'm usually fine. People don't even really know I have it, because for years, I've hardly had any seizures at all. Is that what happened today? Yeah, I sort of took a break from my diet. It's been nice working at Jimmy's with you guys, eating whatever I want, and not having anyone look at me funny or lecture me. Someone had lectured her, though. Julia had. You can still work at Jimmy's, I said. Just don't eat his crummy food. She laughed. I know. Actually, my dad makes me a lunch every day. I've been throwing it in the garbage on the way to school. He's pretty mad. That was hard to imagine. Anyway, my mother found this rose on our doormat when she got home from work. It's like this really perfect-looking rose. Weird, huh? I let her talk about it a little more, about who might have left it and why. I knew she wanted me to say that Colin probably did it, but I just couldn't make myself say the words. The third note. The next morning was the first really cold day of December. You need the jacket with the hood, Mom rasped from her bed. Her voice never sounded normal until after coffee. Look in the front closet. She seemed to think it was really helpful to lie in bed, listening to the radio and calling out weather reports. I couldn't help thinking about how, in my book, Meg's mother had French toast waiting for Meg in the morning. She was a single mom, too, with Meg's dad being held prisoner halfway across the universe. I found the coat, still streaked with gray from last year's dirty snow, and put it on. A little stiff, but it seemed to fit okay. "Where are my gloves?" I called. "No idea. Sorry." "Can I take some money?" "Coat pocket." I felt around in my coat and found a $5 bill and three singles in one pocket and her striped scarf rolled up in the other. I grabbed the singles and the scarf. "Bye!" The laughing man was still asleep with his head under the mailbox. He had found some cardboard to put underneath him. Still, he must have been freezing. Some mornings I'd seen kids banging on the mailbox and yelling, "Wake up, kicker!" I hoped no one would do that today. I watched my breath billowing in front of me and race-walked towards school. The sun was out, but had no warmth yet. I shoved my hands in my pockets and felt a bunch of old tissues. Yuck. And the $3. And something else, a little piece of paper, folded in half. I pulled it out. I recognized your tiny handwriting right away, all wobbly with those weird loops you put on top of your T's and L's. You will want proof. 3 p.m. today, Colin's knapsack. Christmas Day, Tesser Well. April 27th, Studio TV 15. P.S. Yawns do serve a purpose. They cool the brain by bringing air high into the nasal passage, which has the effect of increasing alertness. The note was on the same dried-up paper as the first two. 3 p.m. today, Colin's knapsack. I had absolutely no idea what that could mean or how you knew Colin. Christmas Day, Tesser, well. This one had something to do with my book. To Tesser meant to travel through space or time or both. It was how Meg got to Kamazots, the planet where her father was held prisoner. But it had nothing to do with Christmas, as far as I knew. April 27th, Studio TV 15. April 27th was Richard's birthday. But of course, back in December, I had never heard of Studio TV 15 since Mom didn't get her postcard from the $20,000 pyramid until a couple of weeks ago. I think it was the PS that freaked me out most. I thought of the day Sal got punched when I had carried my Mysteries of Science poster home. I read the note over and over until my hands were frozen and I was forced to put them back in my pockets. It made no sense. The only thing it really helped me understand was that you were watching me. And I had no idea who you were or what you wanted. I was almost to the garage when Marcus came out of his door right in front of me. He had on his regular green army jacket, but he was wearing gloves and had a hat pulled down over his ears. I expected him to ignore me like he always did, but instead he waved and started walking along next to me. Things that make no sense. Marcus and I got to Broadway without saying anything. I was thinking. I thought of a question for you, I said finally. Okay, let's say I build a time machine. I waited to see if he would laugh at this, but he just nodded and looked thoughtful. And let's say I decide I want to go back to last Wednesday. Let's say I want to go to the movies while the other me is still in school. Okay. I exhaled a big white cloud. I won't get to last Wednesday until after I leave, right? I mean, I won't know if I'm really going to get there until I actually get there. Right. In your experience, you won't know if you're going to get there until after you leave. I mean, unless you remember seeing yourself on the street or something. Or we could ask the ticket guy at the theater. He was serious. What? At the movie theater, which one are you planning to go to? Because we could ask the ticket guy if you were there. Then we'll know whether or not you're going to get there. But I haven't left yet. I haven't even built the time machine. So it doesn't matter when you leave. It's just whether or not you get there that matters. Wait, I take that back. It does matter when you leave, because if you don't leave for 50 years, even if you were there, the ticket guy probably won't recognize you. What are you talking about? Well, say you finish your time machine in 50 years. You'd be 62? I said. We were across the street from school, waiting for the green light. I could see kids coming from every direction, all bundled up in hats and scarves. Okay, so let's say you're 62 and you climb into your machine and go back to last Wednesday, December whatever, 1978. You go to the movie theater. The ticket guy would see a 62-year-old woman, right? Right, I said. So far, everything made sense. So, if we went over to the theater today and asked him whether he saw you there last Wednesday, he'd say no, because his common sense would tell him that you can't be that 62-year-old woman, and she can't be you. Get it? I shook my head. If we asked today, he couldn't have seen me anyway. I wouldn't have been there yet because I haven't gone back yet. Duh, said a voice behind me. It's really not all that complicated. I whirled around and saw Julia in a long coat. She was standing right behind us, waiting for the light. Marcus ignored her and looked at me. Are you still worrying about that book? About the kids and seeing themselves land in the broccoli? I said nothing. I wasn't going to have Julia hear any more of this conversation. Think of it like this. Think of it like this, said Marcus, oblivious to the look she was giving us. Time isn't a line stretching out in front of us, going in one direction. It's, well, time is just a construct, actually. Look, Julia said, cutting him off. If you really need to know what he means, I'll explain it to you. This should be good, I thought. Julia is going to explain the nature of time. I turned around and looked at her. Fine, go ahead. She pulled off one of her gloves. They were these beautiful, fuzzy, pale yellow gloves, and she yanked a ring from her finger. I think of it like this, she said, holding up the ring. It was gold, studded all the way around with... Are those diamonds? I said. Diamond chips, she shrugged. Look, it's like every moment in time is a diamond sitting on this ring. Pretend the ring is really big with diamonds all around. And each diamond is one moment. Got it? Marcus was silent, just looking at her. I laughed. Time is a diamond ring, I said. That explains everything. Thanks. Would you shut up and listen? If you figured out a way to bring yourself to another time, probably through some sort of teleportation, you'd be somehow recreating your atoms, really, not physically moving them, I'm guessing. That would be tricky. Can we not worry about that part right now? I said. I'm freezing. We were still standing across the street from school, even though the light had changed once already and then gone back to red. Okay, put it this way. We're kind of jumping from diamond to diamond, like in cartoons where someone is running on a barrel, trying to stay on top. We have to keep moving. There's no choice. Now we're in a cartoon on a barrel? She sighed and shook her head. Okay, forget that. Let's stick with the ring. She held it up again. Let's say we're here. She put her fingernail on one diamond chip. And we figure out a way to jump all the way back to here. She pointed to another one, a few chips away. It wouldn't matter where we came from. If we're on that chip, we're at that moment. It doesn't matter whether we came from the chip behind it or 10 chips ahead of it. If we're there, we're there. Get it? No, I don't get it because what you're saying makes absolutely no... I do, said Marcus quietly. I get it. I know what she means. Thank you, Julia said. I'm glad someone here has a brain. And she stomped off through the red light while Marcus stared after her. I turned to him. So you're saying this diamond chip is just sitting there minding its own business, and then suddenly a bunch of kids land in the diamond chip's broccoli patch? Marcus's face lit up. Stop. I see your problem. You're thinking that time exists on the diamonds themselves. It doesn't. Each moment, each diamond is like a snapshot. A snapshot of what? Of everything, everywhere. There's no time in a picture, right? It's the jumping from one diamond to the next that we call time. But like I said, time doesn't really exist. Like that girl just said, a diamond is a moment, and all the diamonds on the ring are happening at the same time. It's like having a drawer full of pictures. On the ring, I said. Yes, all the diamonds exist at once. He looked triumphant. So if you jump backward, you are at that moment. You are in that picture, and you always were there. You always will be there, even if you don't know it yet. I didn't understand a word of it, and I couldn't feel my feet. Forget it, I said. The whole thing is making me crazy. He nodded like he felt sorry for me and my stupid brain. I think that's probably because of your common sense. You can't accept the idea of arriving before you leave. The idea that every moment is happening at the same time. That it's us who are moving. Enough was enough. I cut him off. Why did you hit Sal? I asked. Who? He looked completely mystified, as if I had just changed the subject from something very normal to something completely insane, instead of the other way around. My friend, Sal, you punched him in the stomach for no reason, in front of the garage, and then you hit him in the face. He nodded. Yes, he said, that's right. But no, there was a reason. That's bull. I know he never did a thing to you. I'd started to really shiver, even with my hands stuffed in my pockets and Mom's scarf wrapped around my head. I did hit him for a reason, he said. What you're talking about is a justification. I'm not saying it was the right thing to do. I'm just saying I did it for a reason, my own stupid reason. I stared at him. So what was the reason? He looked down and shrugged. Same reason I do most things. I wanted to see what would happen. What do you mean what would happen? His nose started bleeding. That's what happened. And he almost threw up. Besides the ordinary things. He tapped the toe of one shoe on the sidewalk. It was dumb, really, really dumb. And what? And did anything happen besides the ordinary things? He shook his head. No, not that I could tell. I was going to tell him that he was wrong, that other things had happened, like Sal closing the door in my face that afternoon and never opening it again, but at that moment I noticed the laughing man coming down the block behind us. I'd never seen him near school before. He was bent forward, mumbling and watching his feet with his eyes on the garbage can right next to Marcus. The laughing man didn't notice us standing there until he was practically on top of Marcus. When he finally looked up, he cursed, twisted away, and took off in the other direction, sprinting like he was running a race. We watched him rush all the way back to Broadway and disappear around the corner. That was weird, I said. Yeah, Marcus agreed. And it's the second time it's happened. The first proof. What did I tell you? Jimmy said at lunch that same day, happily slapping the counter with both hands. They never think you'll actually count the bread. Never in a million years would they think you'd count. The bread order had come up two rolls short. I'd counted it twice to make sure. Jimmy swaggered over to the phone with a huge smile on his face. You just made his day. Oh, you just made his day, Colin whispered. Maybe his whole week. He was folding slices of jam and laying them out neatly on little squares of waxed paper. I watched Colin's fingers as they picked up each piece of ham. He didn't just smack them in half like I saw Jimmy do. Colin sort of bent each slice into a pretty fan shape. Once I started watching, I couldn't stop. It was hypnotizing somehow. I talked to Anne-Marie last night, I said. I think she's coming back to school tomorrow. Colin nodded. Good. It was hard to imagine him sneaking around and leaving a rose on anyone's doormat, but I guess boys will surprise you sometimes. Hey, he said suddenly. You know what? I'm sick of cheese and lettuce sandwiches. He glanced guiltily at Jimmy, who was still on the phone, talking about his missing rolls. Want to go get a slice of pizza? We acted like everything was normal, making our sandwiches and wrapping them up like we planned to eat them at school. And then we ran to the pizza place down the block. It was crazy, but we felt like we were doing something wrong. We rushed back to school, stuffing pizza into our mouths and crouching down low when we passed Jimmy's window so he couldn't see us. Somehow, we became so completely hysterical that we were still having what Mom calls fits of helpless laughter when we got to school. We must have sort of burst into the classroom because everyone looked up from their silent reading to stare at us. Julia rolled her eyes. You're late again, Mr. Tompkins said. And then the whole feeling dissolved and we went to find our books. I sat with my book open on my desk, thinking about the note in my coat pocket. 3 p.m. today, Colin's knapsack. Your first proof. I had to get a look inside Colin's bag to find whatever would or wouldn't be waiting for me. At 3 on the dot, I went to the coat closet and grabbed my knapsack to go home. Colin's was just a few hooks away. I could hear him talking to Jay Stringer in the back of the room near Main Street. Julia was standing with them, trying again to convince Jay about her stupid tinfoil UFO and how it was going to fly up and down the street on a stupid invisible wire. She still hadn't gotten her project approved. I reached over and unzipped Colin's bag. There was his denim covered binder stuffed with falling out papers, a paperback, and the cheese sandwich he hadn't eaten at lunch, soaking through its paper and smelling like pickles. Nothing unusual. I felt around the bottom of the bag and touched some keys on a ring, resting in a pile of dirt or maybe crushed leaves. I tipped the bag toward the light and saw that it wasn't a pile of dirt. It was a pile of crumbs. Bread crumbs. I patted the back of the bag, felt a lump reach behind his binder, and pulled out two of Jimmy's rolls. They were flaking all over the place. Colin must have grabbed them straight out of the delivery bag when nobody was looking. Things you give away. I dropped the rolls back into Colin's bag, pulled my coat on, threw my knapsack over one shoulder, and took the stairs two at a time. There was a mob of kids outside, like always, pushing and laughing and standing around talking, even though it was still freezing and had started to rain. I took a minute to look for Sal, like I always do. No sign of him. I wound Mom's scarf around my ears, turned north, and started walking up the hill to Anne-Marie's. It didn't make sense. Not that Colin had taken the rolls. In fact, that was just the kind of thing I expected from Colin. But my brain was yelling all kinds of other questions at me. How could anyone possibly have known that Colin would take the rolls? And when had the note been put in my coat pocket? It didn't occur to me that you could have left it there the same day you put the first note in my library book about the squirrel village. I didn't get that at all until much later. And why me? I jumped a gutter full of rainwater and took the last steps to Anne Marie's building. Why was I the one getting notes? Why did I have to do something about whatever bad thing was going to happen? I didn't even understand what I was supposed to do. Write a letter about something that hadn't happened yet? Miranda, my brain said, nothing is going to happen. Someone is playing with you. But what if my brain was wrong? What if someone's life really needed saving? What if it wasn't a game? Anne Marie's doorman waved me in. Upstairs, her father answered the door with an unlit cigar in his mouth and asked me whether I wanted some cold noodles with sesame sauce. No thanks. Fizzy lemonade, then? He helped me tug my wet coat off. The lining was all stuck to my sweater. So I walked into Anne Marie's room, balancing my lemonade and an ice water for her, along with a dish of almonds that her father had somehow warmed up. Warm almonds sounds kind of yuck, but in reality, they taste pretty good. Anne Marie was still in her nightgown, but she looked normal. My dad won't stop feeding me, she said, taking a handful of nuts. And he won't let me get dressed. He says pajamas are good for the soul. Isn't that so dumb? I sat on the edge of her bed. Is that the rose? It was on her bedside table in a tiny silver vase, just the kind of thing they would have at Anne Marie's house. She nodded and looked at it. The rose was perfect, just opening like a picture in a magazine. I tried to draw it, Anne Marie said. She held out a little spiral pad of heavy white paper. She'd sketched the rose in dark pencil over and over. Wow, I said, I didn't know you could draw like that. She flipped the pad closed. My dad shows me tricks sometimes. There are a lot of tricks to drawing. I can show you. But I knew I could never draw like that, for the same reason I couldn't do Jimmy's V-cut or get my Main Street diagrams to look good. Hey, I said, maybe your dad left you the rose. Maybe, she frowned, and I felt a little piece of myself light up. He says he didn't, though. But it would explain how the person got upstairs, why the doorman didn't buzz you. I could feel my lips making a smile. Your dad is so nice. It has to be him. I was miserable, sitting on the edge of her bed in that puddle of meanness. But I couldn't help it. I didn't want Anne Marie's rose to be from Colin. Maybe I couldn't stand for her to have so many people and to be able to draw and cut bread on top of that. Maybe I wanted Colin for myself. Anne Marie's dad stuck his head through the doorway. Anybody need a refill? No thanks, I said, even though my glass was empty and my back teeth were packed with chewed nuts. I have to go. Stay for 5 minutes, he said. I put your coat in the dryer. So I had to sit there, thirsty, and then I had to put on my dry, warm, but still dirty coat and take the elevator down to Anne Marie's lobby, where the lamps glowed yellow, and the doorman remembered my name. It had stopped raining. It was too cold for the boys to hang around in front of the garage. There was hardly anyone out on the street at all. The light in Belle's window looked friendly in the late afternoon gloom, and I thought of going in. I had been telling Belle the story of my book, a little bit here and a little bit there. I'd told her how Meg helped her father escape, and I'd described the first battle with it, with IT, which is this big, giant, evil brain that wants to control everyone. I knew Belle would give me some vitamin C's and maybe a paper cup of hot chocolate, but it was getting late, and I didn't want to have to walk down our block in the complete dark, so I decided to keep going. At first, I thought the laughing man wasn't on the corner, but then I saw him sitting on the wet curb, leaning against the mailbox and just watching me walk towards him. For one second, there was something familiar about him, and I noticed for the first time how old he looked. I thought about what Louisa had said about how old people can't get enough heat. Maybe I felt sorry for him. Maybe he reminded me of Mr. Nunzi from upstairs. Or maybe I wanted to do something good to make up for being kind of a jerk to Anne-Marie, even if she didn't really know it. Anyway, I spoke to him. "Hey," I said, opening my bag. "You want a sandwich?" I still had the cheese sandwich I hadn't eaten at lunch. I held it out. "It's cheese and tomato." "Is it on a hard roll?" He sounded tired. "I can't eat hard bread. Bad teeth." "It isn't hard," I said. "It was one of my best V-cuts ever. Probably a little soggy now with the juice from the tomato soaking into the bread all afternoon." Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today. This Beyond the Pages program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I hope you will join us next time for Beyond the Pages. If you have any ideas or comments, we'd love to hear from you. I'm Lavender. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. This young northern flicker is calling from the ground. Sound like trouble? Well, just because a young bird is on the ground doesn't necessarily mean it's sick or injured. At this time of year, juvenile northern flickers are leaving their nests. They fledge when they're 3 or 4 weeks old and almost as big as their parents, 11 or 12 inches long. Although you may picture a woodpecker high on a tree trunk, northern flickers, young and old, actually forage mostly on the ground. So this young flicker, just out of its nest, is poking around in the dirt and leaf litter, looking for ants and other insects. It makes test flights and, day by day, reaches higher and higher into the trees. But you'll still see it regularly, beak down in your lawn probing for food. The best thing you can do for the young flicker, and other fledgling birds too, is to give the bird some space. And especially, keep your cats indoors. Next spring, this bird will probably be drumming on your roof, advertising for a mate. To learn what to do if you do find a sick or injured bird, visit our website, birdnote.org. We'll help you find your local wildlife rehabilitator. I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note's newsletter delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox. Sign up at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No. What's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.